Lecture 35, Historical Development of the Legal Code.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome. In this lecture, I'm going to discuss the development of the legal code from the American Wild West style of shoot first and ask questions later of the Bronze Age period to the maturity of the judicial system in the classical period. This will involve us recapping to an extent, but also expanding on some of the material from the earlier periods and lectures. But I think that's needed anyway, given the scope of this lecture. And besides, some of the things that we talked about were almost 30 lectures ago. Dracon, for example, was the subject of Lecture 5. And anyway, how the law code developed in tandem with democracy is a story unto itself and so deserves a lecture to itself. Before Dracon, there was law in Greece, of course, although it was more of the informal, frontier type of justice. It was eye for an eye style, something similar to the severe law code established by the Babylonian king Hammurabi, who ruled from 1792 to 1750 BC, although the Greeks would have not been very conversant with his legal code. We know from the poems of Homer that disputes between individuals over property or land could be settled by negotiation, but more often than not, they were settled by an actual fight, by fisticuffs. Some lines from Homer's Odyssey tell us that people expected to fight each other when cattle or sheep were involved. Let me quote you a couple of lines here. "A man's heart knows no sorrow or anguish when he is hit during fighting for his own possessions, either for cattle or for white sheep." Cattle and sheep were prized possessions, and they were vital for economic survival in this period. So was land. And therefore, we can understand the need to protect them at all times. We can draw an analogy with the importance attached to cattle in the American Wild West, and the quickness of ranch owners to deal with cattle rustlers, usually by hanging them. At least that's what they do in the movies. Even when law did arrive in the American West, hanging was still the prescribed punishment for rustlers. Homer also tells us that an individual's family got involved in disputes, and that this was also expected. This type of family intervention could turn into the blood feuds that lasted for generations. So, for example, if a father was killed in a fight, it was expected that his son would take over and go after the killer. If a brother got killed, then the man's father or brother would go after the killer, and so on and so forth. So relatives, and that is male relatives, were expected to get involved in disputes even in the early stages of them. What comes out of all this and helps to shape the legal code is the importance attached to the family unit, the oikos, and that importance extends throughout Greek history. We discussed this in a previous lecture, remember. Disputes that stretched over generations were fairly rare, however, and usually both families came to some sort of agreement. For example, the victim's family might accept a payment from the other family. But justice, as we can see, was mostly dispensed on the spot. Getting a third party to intervene as an arbiter rarely happened, except when both parties couldn't agree on anything, or perhaps when both parties had fought themselves to a standstill. And when it did, in other words, when the two disputants turned to a third party, this would either be a tribal elder, that is someone who was respected, probably because of his age or standing in the community, or more usually in the Bronze Age, it would be the king of the palace center. The king could settle disputes by virtue of his royal authority, and his word was law. From Homer, we learn that disputes were heard in public, with the people gathered around in the agora, the market area, and this was probably the only area where a large crowd could assemble. In the passage of Homer's Iliad, called the Shield of Achilles, is described a scene involving two disputants. A number of elders are judging the case, and the people are looking on and cheering from both sides. Heralds are trying to keep them quiet. This is, of course, a scene in a poem, possibly even embellished for literary effect, and we don't know how common the judicial process outlined in the Shield of Achilles actually was throughout Greece. But presumably it was based on how things were conducted, and it's important to note the influence of public opinion on speakers and judges. This is a point we will return to in a later lecture. From all of this, we can see how arbitrary and problematic law in the pre-archaic period was. For example, a king's or a tribal elder's ruling might not necessarily be the best or fairest. The king, after all, was just a man. He had many things to do on his plate, so presumably he couldn't assess or settle all disputes with any expertise or in all fairness. Moreover, how fairly did a fight settle a private dispute? The victim might not be as good a fighter as the criminal, and so the victim would not only lose the fight, but he would lose his case. Finally, the presence of public spectators, who seemed to get involved in the case, shouting and cheering as they heard both sides of the dispute. These had to have had an effect on the speakers, and especially on the elders or the king, as they gave their verdicts. Now, nowadays, there is silence in the courtroom, of course, but not back then. It wasn't until the late archaic period, when we start to have more historical information, that we know the Greeks began to form a formal legal code. As we know, during the Dark Ages, that's the period from roughly the end of the Bronze Age civilization around 1150 down to the start of the Archaic period around 750. During the Dark Ages, the palace center was replaced by a polis that came to be the chief city of a particular area. Think of Athens and Attica. The monarchy also disappeared at the end of the Bronze Age, and its power was replaced by that of the aristocratic families called eupatridae. These eupatridae dispensed justice as arbitrarily as the kings and elders before them, and there was no right of appeal in this period either. It's also in this period, as the Dark Ages start to come to an end and the Archaic period begins, it's also in this period that starving non-noble farmers called hectameroi, the sixth parters, those who had pledged up to 1/6 of their annual produce as a sort of interest payment in return for help, these people started to run into even more severe problems than trying to eke an existence. These severe problems were simply that when the hectameroi could not repay their debts, their farms were seized, and they and their families could be sold into slavery. Now, this is a scenario for civil war, and it broke out, as we know. In other polis, similar grievances had led to aristocratic rulers being expelled by popular rulers called tyrants. There may have been an attempted tyranny in Athens, when Kylon briefly seized the Acropolis in the 630s, perhaps 632. Given his abortive coup, and in an attempt to prevent possible civil war in Attica, as it happened elsewhere, the eupatridae chose Dracon to codify the laws. Now, we covered Drakon in Lecture 5, but as I said at the beginning of this one, it's important to recap so that we have everything fresh in our minds. I mean, I certainly do. I'd forget my head if it wasn't screwed on. Drakon, as we know, didn't stop the civil distress, and perhaps, given what he did, that the civil distress continued was not a surprise. But Drakon began the process that led to a formal law code. We don't know exactly what he did. Administration and justice was still in the hands of the aristocrats, but Drakon seems to have taken some of the arbitrary nature of the dispensation of justice and the punishment for a crime away from the eupatridae. According to our sources, though, it seems that he made the penalty for almost every crime death, and his name gives us our word draconian. More importantly for us right now, Drakon took away from the traditional right of the family to seek vengeance when wronged, and put this right to seek justice in the hands of the state. Drakon's legislation then was a significant advancement in the legal rights of the people, because before his time, the aristocrats were the only ones who dispensed justice, and they also decided the penalties for various crimes. Drakon modified this system by taking the personal element out of the law as far as punishment was concerned, and replacing this with the objective so that everyone knew what to expect. And as I said, this is the start of the development of the law code proper. The people, though, were not appeased. By 600, the plight of the peasants in the countryside was worse. Moreover, we probably have on the scene by now a new class of citizens, the middle stratum of society, the hoplites. They were not faced with economic ruin, but they were still discontented, their discontent having to do with their lack of political rights. And so, civil war broke out. And it lasted a goodly number of years before the eupatridae elected Solon as extraordinary archon in 594 to end the warfare. Now, we know that Solon was unsuccessful ultimately in ending the civil strife, but he did introduce a series of wide-sweeping political, economic, and judicial measures that would transform Athens and its people. As far as his judicial legislation goes, and this is what we're concerned with in this lecture, Solon amended many of Drakon's laws, and he introduced the right of appeal, a procedure called ephesis, against a magistrate's decision. This presumably went in tandem with the court Solon set up called the Heliaea. He also introduced third-party arbitration. In other words, he made it possible for any citizen to prosecute on behalf of another, where previously only the injured party had the right to initiate proceedings. Solon also introduced a number of laws that affected women and the family, the oikos. For example, he laid down rules about what women should wear in public, laws about inheritance matters, speaking ill of the dead, and a law that children had to look after their parents in old age, since there was no social security in Athens. The Heliaea, that's the Court of Appeal, was a tremendous leap forward, and I'd be so bold as to say it was the ancestor of the people's courts of the fully developed Athenian democracy. The Athenian constitution actually says the right of appeal was one of Solon's most significant reforms. Now, the court is controversial, the Heliaea, and some scholars think that the word simply means assembly and that no actual court is meant. However, it's generally accepted that Solon's introduction of the right of appeal can be linked to an appeal court. So what did this appeal court do? The two generally accepted functions are that it examined a case afresh, or it decided whether the prescribed penalty could be exceeded. Whichever of these two is right, and I happen to think the first one, that it considered a case afresh, The beauty of the Heliaia was that it gave non-nobles a much greater say in the dispensation of justice, which for so long had been the preserve of the nobles. Drakon may have begun the road that led to the development of a formalized legal code, but Solon was equally instrumental in the development of the judicial system. What's more, as the Athenian constitution tells us, the people swore to uphold and live by the laws, and current and new laws were set up in public in the agora, the marketplace, for all to see. They were not kept hidden away then, and referred to only by word or in hushed tones. Everyone could now see the laws. And that gave rise, towards the end of the 5th century BC, to a central record office or state archives being established. And this was called the Metroon. A precise date isn't exactly known, but it's somewhere in the period 403 to 399. The Metroon was located in the Agora, and it was a major improvement in the city's administration, because in it were kept copies of laws, decrees, treaties, and so forth, which were written down and available at all times for the public to consult. Connected to the Metroon, and the Boule for that matter, was the cult of the mother of the gods, hence the mater, mother bit of Metroon. And the mother of the gods was the protector of the laws. So the Athenians then, in swearing to uphold the laws, were also swearing by the mother of the gods. So the laws take on this religious significance as well. The problem with Solon's laws is that many were introduced at a later period and ascribed to him to give them a sort of pedigree. You know, if it's a law of Solon, it must be good. That's why in 410, a group of officials was elected called the Anagraphes, the inscribers. Their job was to collect all the laws of Solon and re-inscribe them on stone in a public place. Now, this job was supposed to take 4 months, but in the following year, 409, they were still hard at it. And this is probably because so many of the laws attributed to Solon were not his, and the Anagraphes had to try to work out the genuine ones from the spurious ones. The commission was extended in 409 to include the law of Drakon on homicide. Now, it took Pisistratus the tyrant to address the plight of the non-nobles, as we know. And it took Cleisthenes, the other father of democracy, to end the civil strife properly, as we also know. And although the next few decades were chaotic because of the Persian invasions and the return to influence of the Areopagus in political affairs, this new law code must have continued to develop. We know, for example, that Pisistratus were introduced travelling deem justices, thus taking justice to the people. Also, Cleisthenes is credited with a judicial procedure known as ostracism. Moreover, an offshoot of Cleisthenes' political legislation was a subtle change in the nomenclature for law. Before Cleisthenes, the word used by the Greeks for law was thesmos. This word meant a law that was laid down by a superior body, or a superior person, like a king. In the case of Athens, this would probably have been the council of the Areopagus. Moreover, a thesmos was a law that the people might not agree with, but they have to accept. But following Cleisthenes' legislation, thesmos gave way to the word nomos. And nomos remained the standard word for law throughout the rest of the classical period. Nomos is subtly different from thesmos in that nomos doesn't just mean law, but it's also an accepted way of life by a body of people, by the collective. In other words, a nomos is more representative of the people. It's more democratic, if you like, than thesmos, which has this narrow sense of a few being responsible for making law at the expense of the mass. So nomos is clearly a democratic word. It has to be post-Cleisthenic then. The most important figure in the development of the legal code after Solon was Ephialtes in 462. When Ephialtes introduced his radical democratic legislation, the Athenian constitution tells us that he transferred much of the judicial powers of the Areopagus to the law courts. The Areopagus retained only a few rights, for example, the right to try cases of premeditated homicide, of arson, deliberate wounding, attempted tyranny, and damaging Athens's sacred olive trees. The Areopagus was a very important court. A sign of this is that in Aeschylus's Oresteia, that's a trilogy that was performed in Athens in 458 BC, the Areopagus is the court where Orestes, the son of Agamemnon, pleads his defense for killing his mother Clytemnestra and getting the Erinnes off his back. When Agamemnon returned home from the Trojan War, he discovered that Clytemnestra had taken up residence with her lover Aegisthus. Agamemnon was having a bath when Clytemnestra had him murdered. In revenge for that, Orestes killed his mother, and the Erinnes, these furies, are after him on her behalf. Eventually then, Orestes ends up in Athens to plead his case before the Areopagus. Now, Athena, in the end, recommended in favour of Orestes. So Athena actually pops down from the heavens and gives the deciding vote. What's important about this case, as Aeschylus gives it to us in the Oresteia of 458, is that it's the first real example we have, even though the trial itself is set in the Bronze Age period, it's the first real example we have of the family revenge, that family's right of revenge, passing from the family, the oikos, to the jurisdiction of the state. From vendetta to democracy, we can say. That would be a great title for a movie. But this is an important change. It shows us the importance of the Areopagus, and we also see that the change that Dracon instituted by taking away from the family the subjective element in dispensing law, out of the family and giving it to the state, we see that now that's fully operational, it's up and running. Now, Ephialtes' legislation led to a vast increase of court business and court meetings. An appeal court like the Heliaea, if that was the only one that existed at this time, comprised of the same people, just couldn't sit every day and hear every case. After all, if somebody was found guilty, the chances are that that person would appeal his sentence. So this court was going to get busier and busier. So it was decided at some stage to make a selection of people representative of the entire populace. In other words, a jury of one's peers. This means that by Ephialtes' time, the Athenians had invented trial by jury. And I say this because the Athenian constitution tells us that Ephialtes transferred the judicial powers of the Areopagus to the courts, plural. There had to have been more than one then, not just the Heliaea. And more than one court equals trial by jury. So out of the Heliaea established by Solon grew the right to trial by ordinary citizens being judged by a jury of their peers, which is one of the bastions of any democratic society. As I mentioned on a previous occasion, every year a panel of 6,000 citizens over the age of 30 was chosen to act as jurors. They swore an oath to judge according to the laws, in other words, to uphold the laws properly and to judge fairly and without bias. So you see, earlier in this lecture when I said I would be so bold as to say that the Heliaea was the ancestor of the people's courts of the developed democracy, well, here we are now. There are other developments in the legal code, of course, such as a more formal arbitration system. And I'm going to discuss arbitration in our next lecture on judicial machinery. Ephialtes also entrusted the judicial scrutiny of a magistrate's term in office, called the euthynae to the assembly. And after the assembly conducted this scrutiny into how an archon had discharged his duties, if the assembly found that this archon had been corrupt or inept in any way, it could refer him to a law court, where he would be put on trial. And then at some time in the 5th century, the judicial procedure known as graphe paranomon was introduced. Now, graphe paranomon means something like prosecution for proposing an illegal law. Basically, if someone proposed a new law in the assembly, and any citizen was entitled to do this, he was personally responsible for that law and for ensuring that it didn't contravene an existing one. If someone challenged the proposal, then the law that had been put forward was put on hold while a court decided whether it was legal or not. If the person proposing it had some ulterior motive, then he could be liable to indictment under this procedure called graphe paranomon. And the same is true if the manner by which he had got his law enacted was procedurally flawed. Because a person proposing a new law, even if it's accepted by the assembly, could be prosecuted, could be indicted under a graphe paranomon for up to a year after his law had been passed. And if he were found guilty, or rather found guilty on the same charge of graphe paranomon three times, then that person lost his citizenship rights. He became what was called atimos. He lost his rights as a citizen, and he could no longer take part in political life. This procedure, graphe paranomon, presumably grew out of the desire to ensure that no laws were introduced that might potentially harm the state or contravene existing ones. Exactly when graphe paranomon was introduced is unknown, but the earliest attested reference to it is in 415 BC, the last decade or so of the Peloponnesian War. It soon became something of a political weapon that could be used against opponents, and because of it, ostracism fell into disuse. That's because an ostracism was held only once a year, as we know, whereas a graphe paranomon could be brought by a man against another person at any time. I want to finish my lecture on an innovation that, for me, marks the coming of age of the legal system that Drakon had kicked off in the 620s BC. Many of Solon's laws, as the classical period continued, were getting outdated, which is why, as we said earlier, the anagraphes were ordered to collect all the laws of Solon and reinscribe the original ones on stone. Their job would indicate by this time, 410, 409, that the Athenian legal code was pretty much established. However, something happened at the end of the 5th century that few could have predicted in 410. And that was, in 404, the Athenians lost the Peloponnesian War, and they suffered a Spartan oligarchy until 403. When democracy was restored in 403, the Athenians decided it was time for a clean slate. They decided to make some major changes to their law code, and so they set up two boards of nomothetae. Literally, those who lay down the law, we would translate nomothetae perhaps as lawgivers. And these two boards of nomothetae were to examine which of the so-called laws of Solon and Drakon were relevant and which should be updated. So there's a big difference then between the anagraphes, who is simply to say, yeah, I think this is an original law, I think that's a spurious one. A big difference between that and the nomothetae, who were to say, here's an original law, but is it still relevant? Does it need updating? And this updating of earlier laws was completed in the archon year 403 to 402, the archonship of Euclides. And this archon year was seen as the start of a new legal era for Athens. No law was valid until it had been included in this revision of the laws. So the nomothetae looked at every law. And no prosecution could ever be brought against someone for offences before 403. So this revision of the laws was accompanied by a general amnesty. The Athenians really are wiping the slate clean. At the same time, a revolutionary change was made as far as the decrees passed by the assembly or by the boule became law. Before 403, if the assembly accepted a proposal, it became a law, that's a nomos, automatically. After 403, a committee of nomothetae met on an increasingly regular basis to decide whether what the assembly accepted should become a formal law. Thus, the nomothetae become an interim stage for the enactment of nomoi, that's the plural of nomos. If the assembly voted for a new law, the nomothetae would decide whether it should become part of the formal law code or not. Now, that doesn't mean that if they decided against the validity of a law, that the person who proposed it was automatically subject to a graphe paranomon. Presumably, individual cases were decided on their merits, or lack thereof, because a decision might be taken to proceed with a graphe paranomon against the person. But then again, it might not be. The powers given to the nomothetae can only be explained by the Athenians' wish to have a uniformity in their laws after 403, and to keep that uniformity throughout the 4th century. But it's important to stress the role of the assembly and thus of the Athenian citizens here. The nomothetae could not act independently. They themselves couldn't introduce new laws. This was still the preserve of the citizens in the assembly. Nor could the nomothetae make changes to the existing laws after an investigation. They still had to report to the assembly, which had the final say. In our next lecture, I want to talk about judicial machinery, the magistrates, the courts, and the arbitrators. We'll see in the process that despite what we've said in the past about the role of the assembly in the city, the Athenians may have attached less importance to attending the assembly than in taking part in their legal system. Thank you very much.